Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve making the economy boring again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, the 8th of November today, Thursday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are some things that are going to change in the management of the American economy because of the election on Tuesday. Talk of those new tax cuts is probably dead. Maybe Infrastructure Week will actually happen now. Who knows? But you know what is not going to change? The good old Federal Reserve. The Fed's been meeting the past 2 days to talk interest rates and the state of things. Rates are staying where they are, as we all thought they would. The economy's doing fine, the Fed says, as we all knew it was, which means we are on track for the anticipated interest rate bump come their December meeting. That is the 18th and 19th, by the way. Also, for the record, Jay Powell, very nice guy. Not boring at all. All right. Anyway, speaking of interest rates of the longer term variety than the Fed controls, Freddie Mac said today the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage is up to 4.94%. That's a near 7-year high. And those higher costs, cost of money, right, are taking a bite out of demand. Mortgage applications hit a 4-year low last week, and home sales numbers and price increases have been slowing. So, given our experience with the housing market going south a decade ago, what might another housing slowdown mean for the economy now? Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
When Nathan Messer and his ex were getting ready to sell their 3-bedroom house in Seattle over the summer,
housing prices were shooting up. It was crazy.
But after a month, they weren't getting a lot of bites. So in late September, they took it off the market.
Our asking price originally had been around $700,000, and by the time that we pulled it, we were not likely to make more than $500,000.
Seattle is one city where a previously scorching real estate market has cooled off. Zillow senior economist Aaron Terrazas says one reason is higher interest rates. In the past 3 to 6 months,
home sales have been flat or maybe falling. Prices, while they've been steady nationwide, kind of have decelerated, particularly in those priciest markets.
So what does a housing slowdown mean for the larger economy? Susan Wachter teaches real estate at the Wharton School.
It will, on the margin, decrease the demand for some spending, and some industries will feel it, consumer durables in particular.
Like refrigerators, washing machines, all the stuff people buy with a new house. Real estate and mortgage brokers will feel it too. But Christopher Thornburg with Beacon Economics says unlike the last expansion, this one hasn't been fueled by construction or housing wealth. So if the softer market turns into an outright downturn, it won't drag down the economy as a whole.
Take a deep breath, America. It's not that big of a deal.
He thinks the housing market's just taking a breather. And just so you know, this is a guy who predicted last decade's housing crash. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Let's circle back to the election here for a second, specifically the internal congressional elections that follow Election Day proper, campaigns to decide who's going to lead the parties and the committees in the House and the Senate. Mitch McConnell is going to be on top in the still GOP-controlled Senate. Nancy Pelosi is being very clear she plans to be the Speaker of the House, and there is going to be some jockeying over who sits on which committees and who gets to hold the gavels. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, those committee chair spots might not be as important as they used to be.
Gatekeepers on committees, especially the ones that deal with taxes, spending, and regulation, are pretty powerful positions. But lately,
party leadership has become stronger and stronger at the direct expense of committees and committee leadership.
Laura Blessing at Georgetown's Government Affairs Institute says this isn't a new thing, but has accelerated in recent years. She says a good example is last year's tax law.
I mean, this thing spent about a month in committee and was, just largely written by party leadership without a whole lot of your typical legislative hearings.
But that's not to say there's no power in a committee chair. It comes with oversight powers and control over which issues get a hearing. Hans Hassel is a political science professor at Florida State University.
There are still benefits. They just may not necessarily be policy benefits. They may be pork going back to your district. There may be, you know, ability to claim credit on particular issues.
Others in Washington argue that committees still have plenty of power. Lobbyist Ken Keyes at the Federal Policy Group previously worked with tax writing committees as part of the Joint Committee on Taxation.
Certain decisions might have been made at the leadership level, but they would be the broad brushes. These things are so complicated, the committees are the ones that actually write the legislation.
Keyes says when it comes to really complex legislation, most of the work and the power is still with the committees. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A little lackluster on Wall Street today, to be honest. Not a lot of zip after the relief rally yesterday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Elon Musk has a new boss today. Robin Denholm is her name. The deal the Tesla CEO made with the Securities and Exchange Commission back in October after that whole taking the company private thing turned out not to be actually, you know, happening, let Musk keep running the company. He just couldn't be the chairman of the board anymore. That is, he couldn't be his own boss. The Washington Post's Jenna McGregor covers all things corporate governance. Jenna, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think? Is Robin Denholm going to satisfy what the SEC was looking for in this judgment against or this deal that they had with Tesla?
Whether she'll satisfy the SEC, I think, is a very different question than whether she'll satisfy what investors are looking for. She's got a great resume. She's somebody who is very clearly an independent member of the board. But I think a lot of investors and governance watchers were wanting to see somebody new from the outside who had not been on the board for the past 4 years come into this position.
Right. So let's get down to brass tacks. The next time Elon Musk tweets out something Musk-ish, if we could just put it that way, is she going to have the oomph to go to him and say, Elon, cut it out?
We really don't know. I mean, what we do know is that over the past 4 years, she's been on the board and that hasn't happened.
Do you think it matters that she's from telecommunications, not necessarily manufacturing, and might not have operational expertise?
Again, I think that's something that some people were looking for. I think some people were looking at this board saying, you know, she worked for Toyota, but it was in finance roles. Somebody who had operations at a manufacturing company, chops, would have been a great addition to this board.
Tesla has outsized, not necessarily influence, but outsized impact just because of Musk and honestly, the whiz-bang nature of its product. Its board, though, has been extremely quiet through this entire period of controversy ever since going public at 420, funding secured. That's not typical for a board with a company in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, this board has been criticized in the past for being more cozy with Musk than other boards. They say that only two of its members are not independent, both Musk and his brother, who's on the board. But there are other directors that people have raised questions about their professional ties and wondered whether there is it's as independent as it could be.
Yeah. The judgment with the SEC, the deal with the SEC bars him from the chairman role for, I think, 3 years. 3 years from today, do we see him back in the chairman's job, do you think?
3 years is what the SEC called for. There are people pushing to make it permanent. There's a lot of people out there who think even in your average company where that doesn't have these kinds of issues, they should be separate. And so who knows with this company?
We'll see. Jenna McGregor writes on corporate governance and a bunch of stuff for The Washington Post. Jenna, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So from an electric car company to legacy car makers that are really, really trying to diversify, Ford has plunked down tens of millions of dollars, as much as $100 million, according to one report, to buy the electric scooter company Spin. Last week, Daimler announced it's trying scooters, too. And those two will be competing against the rideshare giants Uber and Lyft and e-scooter originals Bird and Lime for a share of what could be a multi-billion dollar scooter business. Let me say that again, a multi-billion dollar e-scooter industry. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino explains what these big companies are hoping to get out of those little machines.
It's hard to take scooters seriously. They're for kids, right? People look silly riding them. They're flimsy and plasticky. But the scooter business is no joke.
It's a space that's grown really rapidly from almost nothing in over the past year.
Mobility research analyst Sam Abu El-Samid with Navigant Consulting says scooters across the U.S. are now getting almost 250,000 rides a day and bringing in about $1 million of revenue. Uber and Lyft wanted a piece of that business because it was a natural fit with ride sharing.
They're trying to hit all the different types of services that can be offered in order to maximize the revenue potential from these businesses.
Abu El-Samid says the attraction for automakers is the holy grail of transportation in the future.
Looking forward at, you know, a few years from now, as we start to get automated vehicles on the road, we're actually going to need a mix of a lot of different types of transportation.
Even with autonomous vehicles on the road, they won't be the best option for every trip.
60% of trips in urban areas are less than 5 miles. And I think the scooter can fulfill the 1 to 3 mile trip.
Gabe Klein is a transportation consultant who has worked with Spin, the company that Ford just purchased. He says Ford might have an advantage in this space because it's a trusted name that's been around for more than 100 years, unlike its disruptive competitors. In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We take you now to the town of Little Plumpton, Lancashire County, up in the north of England, by way of the Global Petroleum Markets Crude Oil Division, which, for the American benchmark West Texas Intermediate, officially closed today in bear market territory, down 21% from its most recent highs last month. A big chunk of that decline is because of a supply glut, which gets us back to Little Plumpton, where a company called Quadrilla has a 3-month exploratory project going to see whether it can make money fracking natural gas from shale deposits. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, Quadrilla's run into some problems.
On the roadside outside the fracking site, the protesters have settled in for the long haul. Celebrity supporters drop by and folk singers serenade the activists. The aura of peace and love is dispelled when a truck enters or leaves the premises.
The sooner you bankrupt, the better!
Shame on you!
Shame on you! Get another job!
The protesters believe that fracking will pollute the air, poison the water supply, ruin the landscape, and exacerbate global warming.
Fracking is wrong because we have to get rid of fossil fuels if our grandchildren are to have an environment fit to live in.
But this roadside resistance isn't Quadrilla's biggest headache. That would be the earthquakes. Since they started fracking here 3 weeks ago, they've had to stop for 18 hours on 3 separate occasions because they triggered earth tremors above the permitted threshold. It's this, claims protester Bob Dennett, that will spell the end of this technology in Britain.
It's costing them £94,000 per day to run this site. And every time they have to stop for 18 hours, that's costing them $70,500.
That's $90,000 every time fracking stops. Quadrilla has asked for the tremor threshold to be raised. So far, the government has refused.
In his laboratory at nearby Manchester University, geology professor Ernest Rutter is measuring the strength and structure of rock. He says Quadrilla has to suspend operations when it triggers an earthquake of only 0.5 on the Richter scale, which would never be felt on the surface.
It's too low, in your view.
Oh, it's far too low, yes. If you compare this with the situation in the United States, depending on the state, the kickoff level is about 1,000 times stronger.
He says Britain's low tremor threshold is part of the cautious approach to fracking after Quadrilla caused a 2.3 magnitude earthquake in 2011. That stoked opposition, led to a 7-year moratorium, and slowed the progress of this technique here.
It has certainly been very, very slow. Ridiculously slow, really. I'm sure that the Americans would laugh at the British for how slow this process has been.
At least one local business leader shares his frustration. Babs Murphy, head of the Northwest Chamber of Commerce, hopes this region will become a centre for the European fracking industry.
Lancashire was at the heart of the Industrial Revolution, yeah? And we're a pioneering county. So why not embrace this new industry?
She says local companies have already sold $15 million worth of goods and services to Quadrilla, and if the test fracking proves positive, they're eager to tap into what could be hundreds of millions. But I've spent 2 days in this region, and Murphy was the only business person I could find prepared to voice support for fracking.
Why isn't this county full of business people bursting with enthusiasm and eager to talk about this subject?
The business community actually want it. What they don't want are protesters outside of their premises.
Stop shoving me! I've got nowhere to go!
That's why you're angry! You're all bullies!
Protesters and police continue to clash at the fracking site. The protesters say they'll stay until the site shuts down. But Quadrilla has spent $130 million so far prospecting for gas in the UK. It isn't about to walk away either. In Little Plumpton, Lancashire, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So really, in a way, old school is the new school.
Marketing goes back to the future. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials ticked up 10 points, less than a 10% for the blue chips. Closed at 26,191. The NASDAQ down 39, that's a 0.5%. Finished at 7,530. The S&P 500 dropped 7 points, a 0.25%, 2806. Told you about the slowing housing market and what that might mean for the overall economy. So a looky-loo here at the real estate industry, home construction company D.R. Horton hammered down nearly 9% today after reporting that its earnings and sales missed analysts' forecasts. Toll Brothers fell 3%. Tesla sped up 0.9% today on that news of Robert Denholm as the board chair we told you about. Zipping over to those auto companies that are kicking the very small tires on the scooter market. Daimler cruised down 1.9%. Ford sputtered 1.4% today. Drink maker Monster Beverage poured off 3.1% after it said Coca-Cola is developing energy drinks that could compete with its products. The two drink makers have a partnership, and Monster says Coke isn't supposed to do that. Companies have taken the dispute to arbitration. Coca-Cola, wait for it, it was flat. You're listening to Marketplace. Mark in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, wrote to tell us how much he appreciates the way Marketplace presents in-depth news and tells offbeat economic stories he doesn't find any place else. If you agree with Mark, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Kimberly Adams and I were talking about the post-midterm fiscal policy picture yesterday on the program, how the debt and deficit are going to affect policymaking, because they are going to, even if nobody was talking about how much money this country owes during the campaign. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, elections do have a way of changing the conversation.
Here's how much politicians think we care about the budget deficit. Of the more than 1 million campaign ads that aired in September and October, less than 15% even mentioned the budget, much less the deficit. But a Politico survey of registered voters taken right before the election found that nearly half thought the deficit should be a top priority for Congress. Good thing, because we're going to start hearing a lot of this.
They just voted and cheered a bill that would add $1.5 trillion to the deficit.
That was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer pointing the finger at what he considered reckless spending by Republicans earlier this year. And here's then-Minority Leader Mitch McConnell back in 2011 when the Democrats were in the White House and he thought they were running up too big of a tab.
Washington needs to find a way to spend less.
This is how it works on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers are most concerned about the deficit when the other party is doing the spending.
There is tons of hypocrisy on both sides.
Jeffrey Wright is an analyst with the Eurasia Group. He says both parties know the cuts they're calling for won't happen, yet
they can sort of telegraph things that they believe without having to really back it up.
And no one expects them to, because
the deficit is most often used as a hammer to smack the other party with.
That hammer could get a lot of use come January, when Democrats take over the House, the clock officially begins ticking on the 2020 presidential race, and the projected trillion-dollar deficit becomes everyone's favorite subject. Stephanie Miller of Height Capital Markets says the Republicans will show their resolve by pounding away at spending.
So cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security.
Democrats will call for higher taxes.
increases to the corporate tax rate that passed as part of tax reform.
It's still going to be a lot of talk, the kind of talk that Washington's professional problem solvers live for. D.C.'s stacked with nonprofits and think tanks devoted to the deficit. Mark Goldwine is with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
What we hope to do as an organization is sort of leverage the fact that we have a problem and make sure that folks understand that.
Goldwine will accomplish that by traveling the country and telling people they have a problem and should be
letting their politicians know that they want solutions to the debt.
Goldwine's hoping to increase his own influence on Capitol Hill by helping lawmakers arrive at some of those solutions. Lots of people have used the deficit to leverage themselves. In 1986, a guy named Newt Gingrich got his 15 minutes of fame by making speech after speech on the deficit on a nearly empty House floor, all of it carried live by C-SPAN.
The fact is that the United States cannot possibly sustain $200 billion a year deficits for year after year after year.
Actually, it appears we can. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
I'm going to check the mail when I get home, unless one of the kids has beaten me to it. And it's a safe bet that there's going to be a whole lot of advertising in there, specifically oversized postcards and mailers from some brand names and some startups that have decided in this digital age that snail mail is the way to go. Javi Lieber wrote about mailboxes IRL versus email as marketing tools. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So as I said in the introduction, I have noticed this in my own mailbox. Why are these otherwise hip companies resorting to regular old mail?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. I think when people assume the business ways of a startup, they think digital, Facebook ads, Instagram ads, and they definitely are all over social media. Like all of these companies are just competing for the same eyeballs. And it turns out that the mailbox is actually way less crowded than it used to be.
Huh. Also, as you point out, a stamp costs what a stamp costs, but an ad on Facebook or Instagram, which is fundamentally the same company, those ads get more expensive the more effective they are, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. The cost to send something via mail is pretty stagnant. You know how much something costs to print. But then when you turn to social media advertising, I joke that it's really up to the whim of Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
And it doesn't boil down to that, but in a way it does, because these giant tech companies, they control how much these brands are spending on advertising. And the system, and or really more the game, is set up that they want these companies to be spending more and more money.
Huh. A word here about the humble coupon. You know, you can put a coupon code in an email newsletter, but if that email newsletter doesn't get open, it's useless. But if you put a coupon code on the front of a mailer or something, or a postcard, people are going to see it.
That's become an interesting touch point for all of these brands. Like if you look at the ads of Away, Harry's, Casper, Jet.com, Wayfair, almost always there's a coupon code. You know, save $5 at Glossier with code X.
Right.
This is a marketing strategy that's as old as time, right? Like people sure. love a deal. And the interesting thing is these startups really also have us in their back pocket, because the code is a really great way to track a customer.
I will tell you, Harry's knows me pretty well. I'm just saying. The catch, of course, is that we don't necessarily know which works better, right? Snail mail or online ads.
Yeah. I think that these startups are trying to figure out what is the best way to reach the most amount of customers. So they're definitely still advertising on social media. The difference is that on social media, you have a pretty niche customer. So now, you know, they're trying to think about ways to think outside of the box, and that's where mail comes in. But it's definitely not an either-or type of business.
Yeah. And this goes along, of course, with traditionally digital companies opening actual brick and mortar retail shops as well. I mean, it's sort of a journey into the actual in real life space.
Yes, exactly. If you walk around, you know, this one neighborhood in New York City, if you walk around Soho, it has become like direct-to-consumer la-la land. Like all of these digital companies opening stores because they realize, as technologically savvy as their customer base is, they really need to expand and offer them new propositions. And that means opening a store. So really, in a way, old school is the new school.
Oh, that's a good line. Javi Lieber writing at Vox about actual mailers coming to your mailbox through the Postal Service. Javi, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today for the Star Wars fans among you. Disney CEO Bob Iger said on the company's earnings call today that they are working on a prequel to the best Star Wars prequel of all. And don't at me here, y'all. Rogue One. It's going to star Diego Luna, which is great, but here is the devilish part. Disney's going to put it on its soon-to-launch streaming service. So, yeah, another $5, $10, whatever, a month, out the door. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 10 points today. That's less than a 10%. NASDAQ down 39 points, about a half percent. S&P 500, 7 points lower, a quarter percent. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.